The series that I'm doing this week is called Conversations with Fellow Travelers. The person with whom we'll be in conversation this morning is Nell Morton, who is a contemporary of ours. She died, I think, in 88 or 87, something like that. And we'll have a video that we'll look at and then have some discussion of what she has to say. I just want to put, while I've got this captive audience, I want to put a plug in for what I'll be doing in my other three sessions this week. One of my colleagues where I teach, St. Paul School of Theology, Kansas City, Missouri, is Tex Sample, who's just a great human being. One of the things we look forward to in our family all year is the 4th of July, because they live on this lake and they have everybody out to the lake. So we were going out there last April for a celebration for the seniors who are graduating from our seminary, and Heidi and the boys were going to go along, and our 5-year-old said, like, "Oh, we're going out to the lake this week. Does that mean it's the 4th of July?" Because it's something that they just look forward to. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The Tex Sample has written a book called U.S. Lifestyles and Mainline Churches. And in this book, what he tries to do is analyze the different cultural groups within North American culture, within U.S. culture anyway. And I have found it to be the most exciting book I've read in the last 2 years, and it's not just because I like Tex and he's a colleague of mine, but because I think there's a lot of insight in here into our culture and our society and the way it works and the way different social groups are and relate to each other. So, and this book is available in the bookstore. So if you have, it sounds like something that's interesting to you and you want to pick it up and start reading, I would love to have more conversation with folks about that book. So that's the next 3 days.
But the title of that, would you?
It's U.S. Lifestyles and Mainline Churches. And the subtitle is A Key to Reaching People in the 90s. Tex sometimes talks about his work as lifestyle evangelism, because what he's trying to key into, he's a sociologist, and he wants to key into social groups and the particular lifestyles that social groups live out, and then to think about how we in the church can reach those kinds of people. And he writes about all different groups here. The group he's really most interested in right now are the people that he calls the hard livers. And the hard livers are the people who sort of live at the fringe and work hard, but especially party hard. And they're the people that often have drug and or alcohol problems, and kind of people that are involved in motorcycle gangs and things like that. And I think Tex is right when he says that the church hasn't done a very good job of reaching those kind of people. And he tries to work at how we might be able to. That's not what we're doing today, so I'll stop talking about that, but it's something I get excited about. What we are doing today is talking about Nell Morton. And Nell Morton was sort of a foremother to the generation of feminist theologians that came along in the early 70s and 80s. She was quite a bit older than the women we think of in that period, like Rosemary Radford Ruther or Mary Daly or people like that. Nell Morton, I think, was about at retirement age in the early 70s. And so she became sort of a foremother to other feminists. I just want to mention two concepts that are in her that I think are worth noting before we get into the tape. One is that the journey is home, and in fact that's the title of her most well-known book, The Journey is Home. And the notion that I think she's trying to express is that of embracing our journeys and celebrating where we are now rather than always looking off to the future and some sort of future reconciliation. But sort of celebrating where we're at now and claiming where we're at now, which I think is a real important and powerful notion for feminists and for other folks. The other concept of hers that I think is worth noting to start is one that, again, has had a lot of powerful influence on folks. She talks about being heard into speech, And the issue that she's wrestling with, and some of you who've heard me before know this is an issue I think a lot about, folks who are oppressed, be they ethnic minority folks or women or people of other sexual orientations or people of different classes, people who are oppressed, and part of their oppression is that they have no voice. And the question becomes, how can one help somebody find their voice? And Morton's concept was that the most effective thing one can do is try to listen, to hear them into speech. It's not, and the idea there is that folks that don't have a voice don't need to be spoken at or to, rather what will be gracious for them is if we listen to them and honor their stories and give them a place where they can speak. And I think that's certainly true of women and the way that they have been marginalized in our society, but it's also true in different ways for all of us at different times. I like to think that listening to another person is one of the best ways to be gracious towards another person. Because by listening to somebody, we take them seriously and we say, your story matters. Your story matters enough to me that I will give some time and I will hear it. And I think that's one of the most understated but yet profound ways of empowering people is to honor them by taking them seriously and listening to them. And so when I get on my soapbox like I'm doing now, but I really do it when I'm teaching my seminarians, I really try to emphasize that in pastoral counseling, the way I think to start most often is by listening and really trying to hear what's going on with somebody. And that's something that I think is clearer in Nell Morton than in almost anybody.
Jim?
Yes?
Does she talk about, you said, and create a place where people that maybe are more marginalized can speak? Because when you said that, I thought immediately, we don't always think of that aspect. We think, well, why don't women talk up more? Or why, and how to create an environment where that's welcome?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly that would, in fact, I think in part of the tape, one of the examples of that would be a sort of women's, we used to call it consciousness raising group, where women could come together and create a place where they could hear each other. And that's, yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of thing that she's trying to say. Yeah. Okay, we'll see how things are going technically this morning. Never know when I'm at the controls here.
Should we open that
door? Yes.
Yeah,
you would.
Oh, yeah, sure.
One of the technical things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we'll run a ball. Open it up. Power switches on.
Can you pull those curtains to cut down the light contrast?
Should we turn these lights off too? Yeah. Yeah.
In the beginning, God. Everything you do in the world is holy, and every person needs to be free. Many things began to be whispered among the women. A lot of things happened that I didn't understand then when I was a little child. Oh, my life in the mountain. Well, I think from the earliest time that the mountain meant more than a mountain to me. There was something, even as a little girl, it was always there.
Somebody shut that door down
here. And it's strength. I think the river, too. I just loved living there. And I was happy again.
That's good.
Thank you.
I was born in 1905, and I was born in this cabin on the mountain. We were not allowed to go very far away from the house because of wildcats. We thought they were very dangerous, but anyway, that's what we got out.
I'm named for my grandmother, whose name was Ellen, and her nickname was Nell, and Ellen spelled backwards Nell.
My parents were just plain people without a lot of pretenses. My mother was a very strong woman and had deep commitments. The head of the cement plant was a very important member of our church. My mother said, you know, this man is so good, I don't see why he resists putting caps on the stacks to keep the cement dust from filtering over the town. But the idea that she was relating that to religion, he's so good, I don't see why he can't hear, you know, how important it is. I think my mother really agrees without having any academic reason for raising certain questions. I think she raised very profound questions, and I think this is probably where I began to get a lot of my ideas, which came out later. I always intended to do some kind of church work. Since the church stood for liberation, a part of the basic thrust of the church was to liberate people, I thought, well, I'll put all of my energy here. In fact, I thought I would be a missionary. It was at the height of the Depression. And I began climbing these tenement stairs to visit families, living as I had never in my life seen people living before and thought. They did not know how to go about getting away from the kind of jobs they had, or and the little money coming in, and the kind of living. I think that tempered my biblical study, my theology, and everything else. Having that along with a lot of theology just doesn't stand up when you see this kind of thing going on in a beautiful big city as wealthy as New York is, with such beautiful buildings and lovely stores. We had always been poor, but we did have a farm and we did have something to eat and we did have clothes to wear. But here were I got into situations that you just didn't know where the next meal was coming from, and it became a tragic thing. And the whole view of the church, you know, began to be shaken. To begin to do theology out of poverty and out of the lower rung of the ladder is a totally different thing than to theologize, so to speak, from the top rung of the ladder. The hungry maybe would spell out their needs quite differently if we could, you know, hear and hear them say what they need. And you don't go in and talk about religion. You have to talk about the people's lives. And what is religion, you know? And it was just a very, it's a shattering kind of thing. And I just thought, well, is there any hope for the church at all? Is there no place that you can begin to work out the meaning of the gospel?
It is difficult, I think, to pinpoint precisely what it is that the Fellowship of Southern Churchmen did that brought about social change. But I think one thing that can be said, which is fundamental, that is that the Fellowship provided a kind of model. It was a small community of people who themselves were, shall I say, emancipated, who lived their faith. And I think this was the thing to see whenever we met places where we were aliens to the social community. I think we set an example by our very being there, because everybody acted as a human being.
And Mom said, "Oh, Nell, you're leaving the church." And I said, "But I'm not. That's what this is, a fellowship for Southern church people who are trying to live out some of the principles that all churches should be into that." But I never shall forget the sadness that she with which she said that. There was a wave of fundamentalism across the South. That's how the South got its reputation of being the Bible Belt. Northern industries were moving into the South to evade high wages. Many of the industries were subsidizing evangelists to set up tent meetings outside some of these industries where labor was trying to organize, proving by the Bible that the blacks were inferior, or that the Jews had no place in that area. and that labor organizing is the work of the devil.
One thing that was, I think, characteristic of the fellowship was that it consisted of a small group of people who somehow, recognizing the restrictions of the general society at the time, nevertheless managed to sort of live above those restrictions and to
without going to jail every time. Yes,
right.
That is a miracle to me. When you've experienced loving blacks as much as whites, a genuine experience of community, you knew that nothing could separate you two.
There was a kind of opening up of the attitude of people who had been conditioned to separation on the basis of race. The opening up of the attitude, which eventually made it possible for the society to change.
We would go into a community. We would get the community people to be involved and carry on what was doing. We didn't do anything from the top. We made very few pronouncements. When the civil rights movement proper emerged, the white people in the fellowship were willing to step back. And because it was time for the leadership to fall in the hands and step back without trying to be in the forefront anymore. And I realized that something happened to me in the fellowship that never happened before. Once the mind is cleared of accumulated blocks, it is free to embrace new images, positive images, and all sorts of fresh new ways. So I decided to experiment. I was interested to observe how children learn.
Shall we let Ralph help you, sir?
The main thing I learned in working with mentally retarded children is the importance of listening to the child. What is normal? I mean, if these children learn to their fullest to be what they can be, that's the most normal thing in the world. Images. It is from Piaget I first began to get the idea that a child learns by the images that have already been absorbed in a child's life. Images operate primarily in our unconscious. It isn't just what the child understands. Concepts are formed years after images are operated in people and in children. Images are much harder to change than concepts. They cannot be changed rationally. Images. Piaget says that images are formed by imitation.
It is the imagery, the male imagery here that shapes our styles of living.
Nations try to be number one. They even use that we're number one. We are the free nation of all the earth. The domination of the earth, the word power itself, is defined mostly by power over. We try to be superhuman and play God, get so pious. Every culture has to provide its name for God.
Sons of God, in the King James Version, clearly in the early Greek, states children of God, also a number of places in which the translators have inserted man for a more general or inclusive term, such as if anyone have used if any man. Now, of course, these are words, and we see they are used generically, but the images come through.
The church is called the Mother Church. That would include the uterine waters of baptism, the bread and the wine. It has to be blessed, it has to be motherized, so to speak, almost coming from the breast of the mother, which was always conducted by men. In freezing these symbols and not re-examining them and let them come again to life in a new situation, we are contributing to the perpetuation of a dead religion. In the first chapter of Genesis, in which it has Adam being put to sleep to have Eve taken from a rib, is obviously from an earlier myth of the mother giving birth. Because the man does not have a womb. So the rib was taken. That same image was carried over to the crucifixion image of the side being opened, which refers to the whole birth process. Women speak the male language and begin to look at the world from the top level. It is like a God, man, woman, child, the earth. The world looks quite different when it comes from down under, up instead of from above down. When a woman understands that she is not really at the top, she is neither God nor man, but she has her perspective then begins to be changed, and she begins to see things from down under. And this is one thing that causes women to have an affinity with other oppressed people. I thought I was free. I was just scratching the surface. I began to see myself as an oppressed person by patriarchy. It just, my whole life just fell open, and I began to see why things had happened as they have happened. And you see, I had read all the feminist literature, and that didn't faze me. It was only when I saw this was a theological issue, a profound theological issue, and that and that gradually, as I began to see, the church is really perpetuating a lot of the unfortunate social situations that we have today in politics and race and poverty and so forth by its unexamined language. I've just been there ever since, and I think it's I still think it's the most, I think it has cosmic importance. In the beginning was this mystery, this energy that is beyond, still can't control it, we can't define it. and the idol has come out of our own projection there. Every human being in the world is holy, and every person needs to be free. An image may take possession of you, because an image can't respond. Once you rely again on an image, suddenly you don't understand what causes the undercurrent unrest. We don't know what the real human experience is. Maybe it's a variety of things instead of one pattern. And the patriarchal perspective is the choice of one pattern. Instead of the word in the beginning, which is a male word, hearing is in the beginning.
You hear many people say that God always answers prayer, but he says, I'm using that out of a patriarchal, he says, wait a while, or is quiet. And a great deal has been written about Deus ex cogito. And what I am seeing in this now is that silence is the hearing. That it isn't the word of God, it is the speech of the people that is wooed into expression.
Well, I thought I was turning my back on the church, and I was certainly trying to replace it, and that it was that group which eventually came to be called Sister Circle, where I'm at now. Started out as a liberation church, and we struggled with our feelings of pain and anger and hurt that the church wouldn't meet our needs anymore. And what can we do?
The basic thing is to hear the women begin to tell their own stories.
I'm having a strong struggle with my image of God because I want to reject the he, I want to reject the she, I want to reject all this, and yet then when I think of God, I don't know what I've got.
But Ruth, this morning, in the service at our church, at the conference annual meeting, it was totally inclusive, and for the first time in I don't know how long, I felt as though I belonged.
Yeah,
but I was included.
There's a great deal more going on among women than the cerebral. Men are finding that the patriarchal language is extremely limiting, because there are no words for some of the experiences women are having now in terms of spirituality.
You said about you can change or correct concepts, but you have to shatter images. Images can't be changed.
I don't believe in this savior business. I think we've made Jesus an idol. Instead of allowing them to be human, we have a history, a long history preceding the Bible and surrounding the Bible that we have not begun to explore yet.
What I'm interested in doing is reopening the dimensions of the feminine in Christianity to see this very central role that, in fact, the goddess had in the religious experience of Jesus of Nazareth. Originally, the Holy Spirit was feminine, but that became masculine in Latin with the Spiritus Sanctus, and mater in Greek with pneuma, whereas wisdom is feminine in Latin and Greek. And so if you keep that title, you've got a female dimension in the deity that you have to acknowledge. He was like modern Jews who say there is only one God, and that one God is not the human. So that Jesus' comment, there's nobody good but God, why do you call me good, is speaking like a first century Jew, which he was. And I think that he may have conceived of himself as being inspired by God or possessed by God, he did think that people could be possessed by demons, so that it may very well be that he thought of himself as possessed by God, and therefore authorized and empowered and informed and so forth. And the point that I'm trying to make is that the God whom he would have thought he was possessed by was female.
We're given to be human, and it's the one thing, it seems to me, the church has evaded. It may go on and love darkness better than it loves light. You see, the world is constantly changing. Part of the whole meaning, in a sense, of religion is constant movement and constant change. To live in the world now and to keep open for a newer future for our children and the new wisdom, so to speak, of the universe cannot emerge until these old crippling images are shattered. What do you put in this place? That isn't the point. You've got to create space. You've got to, through shock or some way, create enough space for a new vision to emerge.
I think the way that Nell has meant, one of the ways she's meant the most to me is that statement that she continues to make, that you can't throw it all out. It's there, and what you need to do is make it part of you, but move on to whatever the next part of you is.
But you see, it's like my parents. I hadn't walked away from my parents, but I don't live with them anymore. I don't live in East Tennessee anymore. It's brought me to where I am. All of us have a tendency to some kind of religion. Something is our God. In the process of working through that which cripples me as well as that which heals, I'm experiencing a general forgiveness which I did not know I had the potential for, and which in itself is healing. I'm also experiencing a new creative power, not power over, that I trust. This is what I mean, finally, by owning all of me, even the little girl who went back there. Even then, I began to ponder the meaning of journey. There is no road ahead, it's to make the road as we go. The clue of the beginning is more often than not discovered until near the end. Entirely too late to back up and start over again. Maybe journey is not so much a journey ahead, but a journey into presence. The farthest place on earth is the journey into the presence of the person nearest to you.